dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The war on drugs is the prototype for the endless war, providing an expansion in powers for government under the cover of a carefully cultivated popular hysteria, a formula that has been repeated in the new war on terrorism. Drug prohibition also has the effect of keeping the prices of drugs high so that those who do traffic in them may derive maximum financial benefit. On the program tonight, you'll hear an explanation for why there are as many drugs for sale as ever, in spite of billions of taxpayer dollars spent on this endless war. In our first hour, you'll hear allegations that highly placed officials in the U.S. government are engaged in drug trafficking in order to generate an off-the-books stream of cash, which has been used to fund a variety of assassinations and covert wars on every continent in order to further the process of corporate globalization. This isn't a news story, it's just a suppressed story that remains relevant as ever, especially to those it continues to victimize. As a result of the eruption of the Iran-Contra scandal in the late 1980s, persistent stories surfaced that covert operatives in the Reagan-Bush administration were collaborating with drug traffickers. Community leaders were asserting that the crack epidemic raging in their cities was the result of intentional importation of drugs by the same U.S. government that was then arresting the people they'd hooked. Journalists who took on the story, most notably Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News, had their careers destroyed. Earlier, the Christic Institute, a public interest law firm, tried to sue various high-placed Reagan-Bush officials for their role in drug and gun running to fund illegal wars in Central America. But they were never allowed to bring their case to trial. Instead, they were fined more than $1 million for filing a, quote, frivolous lawsuit, which put the small nonprofit group out of business. Many of the people named in that suit were subsequently indicted as a result of a relatively feeble congressional investigation, are once again in top jobs in the current administration. Tonight we're going to hear about one of them, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, now Colin Powell's number two man. Meanwhile, about half of America's 2 million prisoners are in jail because of charges relating in some way to the drug war. Most of these prisoners of the drug war are poor and black or brown. Their lives and their families' lives have been ruined. As you'll hear in our final hour, the corruption of the drug war trickles down even in little ways to Auburn, New York, where these drug prisoners essentially become slaves with no means of redress against predatory prison guards.
One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end for my guns and my
sight. In 1999, 10% of the tiny town of Tulia, Texas, African-American population were arrested on drug charges, all on the word of one white undercover officer. Many of those arrested accept plea bargains and pled guilty even though they were completely innocent. They had been threatened with long prison terms if they went to trial and lost, with only their word against the word of a cop. Dean Becker is a community radio broadcaster at KPFT in Houston, Texas, who covers the drug war. He spoke with Jeff Blackburn, one of the lead lawyers in the effort to free the Tulia prisoners, about the meaning of the Tulia case.
All right, we're going to bring in our guest for the evening. This gentleman was Lawyer of the Year for Texas. He was the main defender to free the prisoners of the Tulia drug sting. I'd like to welcome Jeff Blackburn. You know, something I find very disturbing, that one of the gentlemen, Christopher Eugene Jackson, who was just recently released 2 weeks ago from the Tulia drug sting, has now been accused of evading arrest and punching a police officer and has a $3 million bond. Is that correct?
That's right.
It's just outrageous, sir.
Well, yes and no, but you know, yeah, it's really a classic. It gives us a great way to look into the classic dilemma that's posed, not just by these cases, but all, but by the whole wrong-headed nature of drug policy in Texas especially, okay? A guy like Chris Jackson was a crack addict when he was accused of being a dealer by Coleman. The community in Tulia wanted to get rid of him because he was a drug addict, not because he was a dealer. So they jumped up a case on him, made it up with this crooked cop, because they needed to get rid of him. Everybody was happy, at least everybody with any power, influence, or friends was happy, because they got rid of this nasty drug addict. Problem is that now that we've gotten him out, you know, Chris is still addicted to drugs. He's addicted to crack. He's still poor, and he's still black, and he's still in the middle of nowhere without any friends or money or influence. And 4 years in prison have done nothing but make him more afraid of authority, nothing but more defiant towards authority in a really self-defeating, hostile kind of way, explosive kind of way. And this is what we're going to get. You know, this very session of the legislature, Texas has spent a bunch of time deciding and determining and finally getting rid of anything even remotely resembling a treatment program in or out of the joint. There's nothing out there anymore. For people on parole. If you want treatment, if you turn yourself into the state and say, I'm on parole, I can't make it, I'm a crackhead, I need some help. I can tell you, if you're in the panhandle, that's your problem. Tough luck. You're not going anywhere. You're not going to get any help because there's no place for you to get it. There's no funding. There's no institution. There's no nothing. So Chris, in his own way, you know, on one level, we can look at it and say, oh, it's terrible and it's endangered this whole campaign. But in another, in a deeper way, for people that can think more deeply, like your listeners, it really shows us the true dimension of this bigger picture and this bigger problem. There's no help for a guy like Chris Jackson.
You're right. Jeff, if racism, you know, can exist in American jurisprudence, as with Tulia as an example, and where, you know, equal treatment is supposed to be a bedrock principle, then who's to say that this cancer is not present in other areas of American jurisprudence?
Well, it absolutely is. I mean, you know, our laws, and more important, the way that we run the law, the way that we administer the law, whether you're talking about a jury verdict or a judge's decision or who they bring in for to make a decision on a jury that day, all of that is influenced by everything all around us in this society. And, of course, we have a deeply racist society. You don't even need, you know, folks in Tulia, I've tried to explain this to people, that in many ways the white community there is so racist they don't have any idea they're racist.
Right.
They're beyond even thinking of themselves that way. It's just the way things happen. It's the way things are done. It's the way they think of the world. And I think that's true with a lot of white people, not just in this state, but all over the United States. And those kind of attitudes, those deeply ingrained racist attitudes, are going to make themselves felt. That's why a white guy who gets accused of delivering a gram and a half probably is never even going to go to trial, because he's going to be offered a nice little probation deal. And a black guy like Chris Jackson is going to go to trial and get 45 years from a jury.
Yeah, it's outrageous again. Jeff, you know, along that same line, you know, I've heard it said, and I, you know, as best I know it, it is true that law enforcement admits they enforce the drug laws more against the black community because they say it's good for the black community. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, I mean, regardless of the reasons, I'll tell you why they do it. These guys are in the numbers. They want to make big numbers, because the bigger the numbers, the more money you get. If you can make good numbers with good arrest and convictions, and not good, just any arrest, any conviction, anything to show that you're running people through the system, you're going to get bigger grants that year, and you're going to get finer cars to drive in, and you're going to get cooler stuff, and bigger guns, and more ninja costumes to wear, and on and on and on. It's about the numbers. And if you want to just get really pragmatic and really empirical, because I think that's really all that most cops and even cop administrators are capable of. You know, it's not like there's a deliberate conspiracy to inject racism into the administration of drug laws in this country. There doesn't need to be. It's just easier that way. You're going to go pick on people that don't have any friends and don't have any money and aren't going to hire lawyers. And, you know, that's what Tuohy is such a classic example of. But if you want to see the same thing going on, walk down to the Harris County Criminal Courthouse any day of the week and you're going to see it. You're going to see a black guy over there with a court-appointed lawyer who's probably never met him until that morning and is going to do just the same kind of job that got done on into these poor people up here.
Yeah, you know, it seems that there should be some mechanism to curtail this and you know, the jurisprudence malfeasance that the DA and the cops pretty much just get to run rampant and no one challenges them on their tactics or their procedures because it's public will?
I don't know. You know, I'll tell you what's really interesting about Tuohy for us. What we've tried to do with Tuohy is break out of the normal sort of argument that people like us and probably many of your listeners tonight would make to other people that we know, the kind of normal discussion we would have about drug policy. Break out of that and show people this is the result of numbers-driven law enforcement. Innocent people get convicted. And Tuohy was useful for us as a legal symbol and as a political symbol. And I hope it will continue to be useful. And we're going to keep on making it be as useful as we can make it for as long as we can to generate some, not just thinking about what's going on here, but to begin to explain to people, and I think this is really the key, that the war on drugs is a war on civil rights, that drug law is civil rights law. These are the people that most need civil rights. Believe me, when you're criminally accused, you need civil rights and you need the Bill of Rights more than anybody else. And that drug enforcement policy in this country is the number one pressing critical civil rights issue confronting not just African Americans, not just Hispanics, but every single American that cares about the basic constitutional setup that we claim to live under here. Drug law is the cutting edge of the whole process. And what Tuohy, we hope, those of us that have been working on this case for all this time, myself and Randy Credico from the William Kunstler Fund, what we hope is that through this case we can show that this is not just a drug case, this is a civil rights case. And in doing so, that every drug case in this country right now, and certainly every drug case in Texas, is a civil rights case. We've got to think differently as a people about what these prosecutions are really all about and what they do.
Yes, Jeff, you're right. It brings to mind, you know, I've seen over the last several months hundreds of letters to the editor and editorials, strong, biting editorials from papers all across Texas and even all across the nation about this Tuohy situation. And about 10 days ago, the Center for Public Integrity released a report on prosecutorial misconduct, and I did a quick analysis of the database for Houston, and it showed about 75% of the cases in Houston that they studied showed prosecutorial misconduct. Your comments on that?
Oh, it's absolutely rife and rampant. But this does get me to another sort of perspective that those of us who've not only worked as lawyers in this campaign, but are also have also worked as activists and campaigners around this Tuohy issue, are focused on right now. The truth is, there are some things that can be done legally. There are laws that can be changed and laws that can be made that would do a lot of good in preventing this kind of situation from happening again. What I'll tell you right now, what we're really looking at focusing on is sort of capitalizing on the strength and some of the momentum that we've generated around Tuohy to carry that forward to the next Texas legislature. And I'm going to be in Austin meeting with people in just a couple of weeks, people from the ACLU and other organizations, in a new effort to sort of galvanize ourselves to make this the legislative crisis of the next Texas legislative session. And there are some simple things that are about simple justice that regular people can get behind. For example, we need a public defender system in this state, period. I can tell you, if there was a real public defender system, which no matter how bad it was, would have been 1,000 times better than the court-appointed system that we suffer from now, which is a judicial patronage system where appointments are handed out to somebody that's a good toady for the judge. If we had a public defender system, what happened in Tulia wouldn't have happened. That's one point. Another point, abolish these drug task forces. They got to go. Another point, in all numbers-driven law enforcement as a technique, reestablish some degree, even an implicit degree of community control over law enforcement. Number three, we need to impose a law that says cops have to be corroborated in drug delivery cases. These aren't, you know, these legislative reforms that we're talking about are not pie-in-the-sky, unobtainable goals. I mean, it's not like we're talking about free health care for everybody here. This can be done. We could do this if we had the will to do it. And we're going to be spending the next couple of years using Tulia and other cases like it around this state, including in Harris County, as great examples of why this has to be done. We need to establish an innocence commission in this state. It's already been proposed by Rodney Ellis from Houston. That proposal needs to be adopted, and that needs to become the law.
I feel there's a parallel there between what happened when they decided to go after Tom Coleman and they quit looking at Terry McEachern, Larry Stewart, and Ed Self. I think we need to keep our eyes open on all these guys. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. Cops love scapegoats. And if you can find one guy to single out, prosecute and appease the masses with, throw, make him a bone that you throw to the dogs and say, hey, now look, our system works. They'll go for it every time. The truth is that, like it or not, government is the teacher of the people. Things do start. They don't end, but they start with policy in this country. And I think that's why this show is important, and that's why we're all together, and that's why we're having this discussion, because we all know that the critical importance of law and policy in this country. So I think if we changed our policies, we could begin to change attitudes. That's really got to be the role of government. Now, that's very abstract. I want to give you a concrete example of what we're really hoping to do in Tulia. Our next step in Tulia is not to just keep pummeling these bad guys and demanding their indictment and frankly ruining this county, which we could do if we wanted to. Our next step in Tulia is to show them some of the mistakes they've made, and we are engaged right now, unbelievably enough, in a very serious series of discussions, we being the Tulia Legal Defense Project and William Moses Kunstler Fund, on the other hand, with Randy Credico. Credico and I are both involved in very, very in-depth discussions with the county judge, members of the county commission, the chief of police, and other establishment figures in Tulia. They have learned how wrong this drug war can be. This experience has begun to really eliminate their commitment to the drug war concept.
That was defense lawyer Jeff Blackburn speaking with Dean Becker in Houston, Texas. Next, we're going back in time to hear an interview recorded in 1991 in Los Angeles. The interviewee, Colonel James Bo Greitz, was one of the more surprising characters to go public during the Iran-Contra scandal in the late 1980s. The interviewer is Dr. Kwaku Person-Lin, a professor of black studies at California State University. Unfortunately, the sound quality is poor, but I hope you'll find the information sufficiently compelling to make up for that.
Greetings. I'm Dr. Kwaku Person-Lin, and we have a very special guest with us today, Colonel Bo Greitz, who is going to give us some information that we've heard of him, and we haven't heard a lot from him. So welcome to our audience here in Los Angeles.
Well, I want to thank you because it was your audience in Los Angeles that helped steer this nation back on course a few degrees. One of the people I'd like to talk about is a man named Richard Armitage. He was, under Ronald Reagan for 8 years, the Assistant Secretary of Defense. He was responsible for the return of American prisoners of war, the accountability of missing in action after the Vietnam War was over. He was an agent for the CIA. The President of the United States was, of course, director of Central Intelligence. So a lot of CIA operatives have worked their way into the other offices of the executive branch. We have, on three different occasions, literally had American prisoners of war in our hands. We've never been able to bring any home alive. I couldn't understand why. General Westmoreland, in his book, A Soldier Reports, did me a great honor, I think. He cited me out of 5 million Vietnam veterans as the American soldier. He cited two examples. One of them was when we recovered a U-2 spy plane captured by the enemy that wasn't destroyed, as Francis Gary Power's plane was during the tenure of Khrushchev and Eisenhower. We've performed 100 missions or more behind enemy lines, very difficult missions. I couldn't understand why we couldn't bring home prisoners of war. But in 1986, Vice President Bush, at that time, had information that General Khun Sam, who was the overlord of the Golden Triangle, had American prisoners of war. Now, the Golden Triangle is located in Burma, and from the Golden Triangle comes 90% of the world's heroin. I had never been into Burma. We didn't fight the war there. In my own imagination, maybe we were going to be dealing with some Jabba the Hutt that lived in a great Taj Mahal hidden away in an ebony and emerald jungle. We found, however, when we got there, because we did accept the mission, that there was no agent within the Central Intelligence, Drug Enforcement, or Defense Intelligence Agency that had the capability of penetrating Khun Sa's stronghold. Bottom line is, we got there. Khun Sa did not have any prisoners of war. I made three videotapes. Two of the videos were of interviews where I polygraphed agents that had reported to Vice President Bush that Khun Sa had prisoners. The third videotape that we gave just before Christmas of 1986 to the White House was a simple offer from General Khun Sa himself. For the first time speaking on videotape to an American president, as far as I know, Khun Sa said, "I will stop every ounce of heroin that comes out of the Golden Triangle, and I will divulge every U.S. government official who has been my best customer for more than 15 years if America will help me to legitimize my economy so that we can become a true nation state away from communist Burma, as we have a right to in accordance with the United Nations agreement in 1949. Well, I'm not a diplomat. I'm just a soldier. I brought the three videotapes back. I thought it was shocking that, and I didn't believe him, that American officials had been his best customer in the trafficking of heroin. At that time, in 86, it was 600 tons. In 87, it jumped to 900 tons. I received no interest from the White House when I inquired about Khun Sa's offer to stop all of the heroin. As a matter of fact, I was told that there was no interest in doing that. I returned in 87 to Burma, determined to find out why, when Nancy Reagan was saying no to drugs, why, when America was overdosing and Ginsburg couldn't sit on the Supreme Court because he smoked marijuana, once as a Harvard law professor, why there was no interest in stopping 700 tons and cleansing our bureaucracy of apparently some human sewage that was there. General Khun Sa in 1987 gave me, again on videotape, with 25 witnesses who had actually dealt personally, had personal knowledge. They were the heroin factory commanders that are in Laos and that are in Burma and in Thailand and in China that worked for him. He assembled them all. And there he said, "Colonel Bull, I cannot tell you the U.S. government officials I'm dealing with today, because if I did, it would cut my economic throat." He said, "But I will divulge to you some of those that we have dealt with in the not-too-distant past." And then he began to name, and he named Theodore Shackley, who would have been head of the CIA had not George Bush been appointed by President Ford in 1975. And then he named as the distributor of heroin, Santo Traficante, who was a known mafia chieftain in Havana. The CIA got him out of jail once Castro took over. We hired Santo, the CIA, to kill Castro, but he didn't. We hired Santo Traficante. He, meaning General Kunzoff, named Traficante as the principal distributor of heroin once it was out of the Golden Triangle, gotten out through official badges and credentials of Theodore Shackling. He then described the bag man, the man who he said dealt with the banks in Australia, and this was none other than Richard Armitage. Now, he went on to name others, but when he said Richard Armitage, it turned a light on for me, because Armitage had been responsible for our prisoners of war coming home. If it was true that he was the government bagman, then he would be the last human on earth to want to see prisoners come home alive, because when our brothers do come home, there's going to be an investigation to find out who in the bureaucracy was responsible for their return. And, of course, Richard Armitage would be identified. And then the question would be asked, what was he doing if he wasn't bringing home prisoners of war? And there would be a legion of witnesses that would testify that he instead was part of a government drug operation. And, of course, the third question is, because Armitage is not the head, he may not be the tail, is who were your bosses, who was telling you to do this, who were you working for? Now, I have, by my own experience in 1986 and 87, with videotape, determined that there is drug connection right out of the White House, and that the war on drugs that has been declared is a war of words, and I believe not a war in earnest.
Okay.
I commanded special forces in Latin America the same time that George Bush was head of the CIA. I was in Latin America from 75 through 77. During that period, I became well aware of Manuel Noriega. He wasn't the dictator of Panama then. He was a lieutenant colonel, intelligence chief for the dictator, who was Omar Torrijos.
Mm-hmm.
I originally got on to him because we were experiencing sabotage within the Panama Canal Zone just before the turnover by Jimmy Carter. And we determined that it was Manuel Noriega who was behind it. In investigating and in building our dossier, because I was responsible for covert operations in Latin America, I was responsible for special forces there in Central America.
And what years were this?
This was 1975 through 77.
Okay.
And during that period, we found that he, meaning Manuel Noriega, was not only a saboteur, not only was he a personal friend and a communist of Fidel Castro, but he was also literally, in those days, the funnel through which drugs were pouring in to the United States. I recommended immediately, and I set in motion an operation that would have assassinated Manuel Noriega. I was told, not by message nor by telephone call, but the chief of military intelligence came to Panama and told me to keep my hands off of Noriega, that he had, quote, immense value at the highest level. When I inquired what this great value was, I was told that we were paying him as much as the President of the United States to be an intelligence asset. He was working for the head of Central Intelligence Agency, who at that time was George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it didn't make sense. But again, I was just a soldier. I followed my superior's instructions. Even though I had a plan, I had an operation that would have literally taken Manuel Noriega out of existence in 1976, and we wouldn't have even missed a coffee break. We didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because I would not cover up, erase and forget the information that I've learned in my assignments as a special forces commander, I was told I would serve 15 years as a felon in prison. But it's so important. America is far more important than any one man's life or freedom. I went ahead and insisted on giving these videotapes to the U.S. Congress that I have. I was charged with misuse of a passport. Now, It was a weenie charge. They tried to get me for several other things. They promised me 15 years. 5 years they wanted to put me in prison for training Afghans.
Mm-hmm.
I did, out here in the southern Nevada desert, much like the Middle East. And I did it. But the grand jury saw through that it was sponsored by the State Department, and so, of course, there was no true bill. Then they were going to indict me in Los Angeles for the violation of the Neutrality Act, because more than 10 times I have been behind enemy lines since 1983, never with the enemy's permission. And again, I'm guilty. I did it. But the U.S. attorney in California heard testimony from the FBI that I was an agent for the intelligence support activity, an arm of the National Security Council, and so they declined to prosecute. Finally, here in Nevada, the U.S. attorney, a man by the name of Bill Maddox, agreed to indict me for misuse of a passport. It threw me in league with Jane Fonda, who cavorted with the enemy in Hanoi and was never under passport violation. It threw me in league with Ollie North and Robert McValliam, who had gone to negotiate an illegal arms deal in Iran on Irish passports.
Mm-hmm.
But I was indicted. I was acquitted. After the acquittal, the U.S. attorney here stated before three television news stations that George Bush had called him on the phone and told him to, quote, get Fogg right. When one journalist said, are you denying that? Is that what you're saying? Bill Maddox on television, have the tape, said, no, what I'm saying is that George Bush called me on the phone and told me to get Fogg right. Now, I simply sent those videotapes to the president and to the attorney general with the exclamation that if you did this, you did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't do this, then the U.S. attorney in Nevada is a liar, and either way, you got big problems. Well, Bill Maddox lost his job.
Mm.
He's seeking employment now, doctor. And the chief deputy attorney was also interesting. He's now a part of California. He turned out to be Country Joe and the Fish's roadshow manager. I didn't know it, but the newspapers dug it up. Country Joe and the Fish were probably the most violent of the anti-war protest groups.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, members of the band couldn't believe that L.J. O'Neill, who was the chief deputy, U.S. attorney for Nevada, had turned out to be a Fed because he, quote, was such a good acid head.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, the government has taken a lot of casualties because of what they've tried to do wrong. Here's what I would warn your listeners about. I read in the paper today, doctor, where it said that the American people are demanding that Manuel Noriega tell all during his trial. I was also happy to be charged by the federal government. You can't sue the government, but they were suing me. I was going to simply use as my defense that, yes, I had misused a passport because the government had asked me to, and I would show the government involvement in drugs, and I would show that the government had been keeping our prisoners of war from coming home, all because they didn't want to have disclosed their involvement in drug smuggling.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my defense.
I wanted to ask you, what do you think the government has to fear from Noriega supposedly telling all?
Well, they have nothing to fear, doctor, because this is my point. Here's something that I'll bet you didn't know about. You know, my defense attorney was Lamont Mills. Mills was the U.S. attorney for Nevada for the first 4 years under Reagan. And he didn't charge me anything. Thank God for that. Otherwise, I could have never survived the 2 years that they delayed my prosecution. But the last delay that the government used was a thing that you're going to see them use on Noriega. It's called the CIPA, C-I-P-A. It's an acronym that means the Classified Information Procedures Act.
Mm-hmm.
It's only been used a couple of times in the history of America. Once was with me. So afraid was the administration that I would bring out this government drug involvement and the prisoner of war issue, that they used the CIPA. The CIPA is an act that they will use with Noriega. It means that before any witness, before before any kind of evidence can be presented by Manuel Noriega or his attorneys, it must be heard before the judge and a team of prosecutors, which will include security officers, probably from the CIA and from the administration. If any of that is determined to be in any way prejudicial, then it will not be allowed by the judge to be presented before a jury or the media. So what you're probably going to see in the case of Manuel Noriega, once they have scrubbed his defense, they've denuded him of his defense with this SEPA Act, is a very whitewashed, a very vanilla presentation. Because if they do mention even one bit of evidence that the judge has excluded because of SEPA, then it is contempt of court that will be brought against defense attorneys. You know how defense attorneys are.
Right, right. Let me ask you, are you prepared to name any government officials now that you know of involved in the drug trade?
Well, those I've already named, Doctor, were named to me not only by, and I was in Burma, 12,000 miles from here, not only by Khun Sa and his staff, but H. Ross Perot, who is a Texas billionaire,
mm-hmm.
is another person who, at the time, I didn't know was involved. But police agencies, especially in California and in Washington, D.C., have been frustrated trying to indict Richard Armitage under the statutes of drug smuggling and Asian gang problems that actually arose because of the investigation of Asian gangs because of murder, extortion, and drugs. And every time, according to these police reports, that they got into the investigation, Armitage's name surfaced often. Most of the people, apparently, who were at the bottom of this Asian mafia were assassins for the Phoenix program.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to dilute our conversation by going off in so many directions,
mm-hmm.
but it all ties into the small group of people we're talking about.
Could you briefly describe the Phoenix operation?
The Phoenix operation was a brainchild of someone in the ivory towers at Langley in Washington, D.C., the CIA headquarters, where they thought that if we were to assassinate the infrastructure, the support of the communists in South Vietnam, that if we did lose the war, that if the North did come in, there would be literally nothing to take over. There wouldn't be any support, and so they would implode. They would just collapse internally. Now, the problem with this is that who do you get to go out and find and execute infrastructure? Because soldiers wear uniforms with red stars, and they carry Kalashnikovs. They're easy to identify. But how do you identify the sympathizer, the person who would aid and abet and give information and give comfort and support the Communist Party? These aren't easy. Well, who you get here, you get the thugs, you get the murderers, you get the mafia. These people do not go to the trouble of investigating. Most of the Phoenix program is credited with killing a minimum of 50,000 Vietnamese civilians.
Mm-hmm.
I personally believe that most of these deaths were of innocent people. I believe that they were extorted by thugs, and that if they ran out of money or if they wouldn't pay the extortion, that these thugs then killed them. We paid these thugs.
Mm-hmm.
We paid these murderers, these official assassins, according to the number of ears that they brought in. Only the right ear was acceptable. Once the ear was presented along with the dossier, then that man was paid for that particular life that represented. Now,
I remember I was in Vietnam myself, and I used to see guys wearing necklaces with ears.
With an ear. Well, the Phoenix, the problem, the horrendous crime is that most of these murderers, men that you would not invite to supper, most in your home, most of these murderers got first priority to come to the United States when the war was lost,
mm-hmm.
because, of course, they were active U.S. agents, and Richard Armitage sponsored many of them.
Okay, could you, for our listeners just tuning in, we're speaking with Colonel Bo Gripes, and could you again tell us who this Armitage person is?
Well, remarkably, during Reagan's administration, Armitage was the Assistant Secretary of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
When George Bush was elected president, he appointed Richard Armitage. Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, putting him over the Golden Triangle, putting him over the prisoners of war, making the most powerful man in America. Now, what happened, because I congratulated you and your listeners when we first started this interview, because of talk radio, enough Americans got angry that they called Claiborne Pell. Claiborne Pell is a U.S. senator in charge of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He is the man who would have to confirm Richard Armitage before, even though the president appointed him and Armitage was there and working for months as the Assistant Secretary of State, still the Senate Foreign Relations had to put their rubber stamp on it. And Claiborne Pell finally got enough phone calls right from Los Angeles that he finally said, stop it, we will investigate Richard Armitage as a heroin smuggler. Rather than be investigated, remember John Tower and the that he brought the administration when he was appointed Secretary of Defense? Well, rather than stand for investigation, George Bush unplugged Richard Armitage from Assistant Secretary of State and put him in as the Secretary of the Army. Now,
does he hold that position now?
Well, no, sir. Because of you, he's not. If you were in Vietnam, you'd said it. So you know that we lost 58,000 and more young men and women, average age 19, to hostile fire. Their names are on the Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C. today. But you know that we lost 75,000 young Americans to drugs. When I heard that Richard Armitage had been appointed Secretary of the Army, it made me so angry. Again, listeners, and principally from Los Angeles, listeners began calling, this time, Sam Nunn, because he was the Senate Armed Services Committee chairman who would have to rubber stamp Armitage. Finally, Nunn said, turn off the bubble machine. We're going to investigate Armitage. Then you know what happened, Doctor? Armitage immediately, inexplicably, resigned from government service. But here is the final note on that. Well, I hope it is the final one, but here's the last note I've heard. Just recently, George Bush has indicated that he is going to appoint Richard Armitage as his personal national security advisor. They can't afford to have Armitage out in the open where he can be prosecuted under the RICO statutes. And so to keep the umbrella of national security, George Bush is going to take a man who H. Ross Perot had police reports saying that he had been a drug smuggler. Perot went to him, you can imagine. Perot is about 5'7". Armitage is about 300 pounds. Perot didn't send a messenger or write a letter or make a phone call. He went to the Pentagon. He pinned Richard Armitage and demanded that he resign as a heroin smuggler. Perot then went to see George Bush. Bush wouldn't do anything for him. He went to see William Webster. You got to remember, Perot's got $4 billion in his bank account. Finally, Carlucci, who was a deputy director of Central Intelligence, a national security advisor, and Secretary of Defense, called Perot in and told Perot to leave Mr. Armitage alone. Now, Perot told me, he was going to be here to testify at my trial. Perot told me that what he had found in his own private investigation of drug smuggling at the highest levels in the administration was, quote, a snake pit without a bottom. He said they will do anything to keep this covered up. And so there you have the connection with Richard Armitage and who and what I believe. Matter of fact, there's one other thing, Doctor. On Perot represents the right side, meaning the conservative side of this thing. But the Christic Institute, which has an office, Father Bill Davis is the man in charge of Christic. It's a Jesuit, Catholic-based organization in Washington, has an office in Los Angeles. They also, unconnected with me or with H. Ross Perot, none of us, I don't really think, knew that we were all on the same trail, but we ended up at the same trailhead. Christic Institute actually had affidavits, sworn affidavits, multiple affidavits, that Richard Armitage was a heroin smuggler for the government. And you know that they even charged him, but their case in Miami, Florida, was just summarily, without ever being heard, thrown out. It's currently under appeal right now in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay, one of the critical concerns here in the American African community, the black community, is that Black people do not own the ships and the airplanes bringing the drugs into the community. We're having a very, very serious problem with drugs, and it's motivated gangs to a lot of destructive behavior. Who is bringing the drugs in here in Los Angeles?
Well, sir, directly into Los Angeles, of course, your best sources would be the FBI covert operations and probably LAPD covert operations. I don't know, but I do know this. Kun Sa said that through, and the ones he was describing to me, that the CIA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the officials within that are working within this drug network, use their badges and credentials to bring, and this year it was 2,200 tons of opiates and heroin into the free world. They bring it out of the jungle to an airfield called Mae Hong Song. It's right on the Burma border. From there, official Thai military aircraft fly it to Bangkok, to Singapore, to Hong Kong, and it is distributed around the world. Now, when we look at Colombia, for example, and the cocaine problem, and the Iran-Contra, we see where the CIA, now during Vietnam, you know that we had a thing called Air America, better known by the GIs as Air Opium, that flew the opium in those days. In Nicaragua, in that situation, it was Southern Air. Now, Southern Air used large aircraft capable of carrying 26,000 pounds of munitions. They flew these arms down and landed in Costa Rica and Tegucigalpa in Honduras. They loaded the aircraft then with drugs and flew them back into Homestead Air Force Base, Laguna Seca Army Airfield, and other military installations. Now, of course, there in Los Angeles, you have Norton Air Force Base, you have Davis, well, let's see, what's your other Air Force bases out
there? March.
Marine and Naval and Air Force facilities. So, if Kun Sa and if the people that have testified in the Iran-Contra and with videotapes are not lying, then the contract aircraft actually fly with diplomatic immunity, because these are all CIA aircraft. They fly into military fields, it's then loaded aboard vehicles, trucks, and of course then it gets into the mafia for distribution. One thing that's of interest, I think, and this you'll appreciate, J. Edgar Hoover, Mr. Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., you know, Mr. FBI,
right,
the conscience of America, is really the man who gave license to the FBI. Albeit he didn't do it wittingly. J. Edgar Hoover made this statement before he died. I bet he wished he'd have kept his mouth shut. Not so many people would have heard him. Hoover said, quote, "We don't care about people who use heroin." He said they are un-American and mainly in the black ghettos. Now, for the CIA, who desperately needed to get into Laos and Cambodia, as you'll remember, Doctor, they had no help from Congress. Congress said no to any involvement. Congress didn't pay for a single bomb or soldier. And you know, as I do, there are as many bomb holes in Laos and Cambodia as there are in Vietnam. And we fought the war in Laos and Cambodia. I had a Cambodian army myself. That's what I had from 1964 till 69. I was a chief of special operations in Vietnam. I worked with Cambodians and with Chinese. And we were all over the place where we weren't supposed to be. And the money was provided through the running of drugs. And J. Edgar Hoover said, don't care, because they're un-American. Well, if it's un-American, and if it's mainly the black ghettos, and the conscience of America, J. Edgar Hoover, who's the head of the FBI forever, says it, then it means it's okay for the CIA to deal in heroin. So we have, and so we are. And so we are not only dealing in heroin, but also in cocaine. And so 15 years ago, it was 60 tons, Doctor. And last year, it was 2,200 tons. Business is good.
This gives the assertion, then, and then I'm going to ask this question for you to verify it one way or the other, that drugs, be it heroin, cocaine, opium, or whatever it may be, could not come into the United States at the volume that it's coming in without U.S. government cooperation. It's, would you consider this a true or non-true statement?
Well, sir, you've obviously actually got the intelligence to see that that is true. And, you know, people like myself didn't think about it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Clear Kunsai is, he's an illiterate person. He is the overlord of the Golden Triangle. There's no number two.
Mm-hmm.
He's the boss. But he doesn't read nor write. But yet he looked at me when I said, I don't believe you. I don't believe that there are born in America, raised in the USA, agents that are using their badges and credentials to run this heroin into the free world. And Kunsaw said, he appealed to my logic. I've got three master's degrees, so I'm not a dummy academically speaking. He said, how do you think we get 600, because this was 1986, 600 tons of heroin on muleback all over the world if it's not done by badges and credentials? And he's right.
Mm-hmm.
And it went to 900 and then 1,200 and then this year 2,200 tons. Doctor, there's no question. The drugs that come in the volume they do. Now, there's going to be drugs come into America.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be drugs grown and narrowed with the synthetics, drugs made here in America. But they wouldn't be, as you said, in the great overdosing quantities. You know that Nancy Reagan said 90% of the high school graduates in 1988 had at least experimented with illegal narcotics. I just came from Alaska. 60% of the high school students in Alaska are using illegal narcotics. That's their own figure.
So what do you think the purpose and goal is of this cooperation from the government and others of bringing this drug? Is this strictly economic? Is it a way to control the population? What do you think the ultimate goal of this is?
Well, thank you, sir. I believe you know the answer as well as I. I hate to say it. I mentioned I had three master's degrees.
Right, but we have a large listening audience who's intently listening and not knowing what this is all about.
You know, soldiers are taught to tend to their knit, and I've been a damn good soldier. I'm considered to be the most highly decorated Green Beret commander, and I fought hard for this country. I love this country, but I'm not a dummy.
Mm-hmm.
I have asked the same questions that you're asking of me, and here's what I believe. There is a one-world conspiracy. The conspiracy is, you've read it in the scriptures, it's based on the almighty dollar. Money, I really believe, is probably the root of all evil. There are a round table group of people who would plan years ahead for the economy, for the good of the world. These people have decided that certain things are going to happen, that they are going to merge America with the Soviet Union, with all other nations. We've got the European Common Market now that will come up very soon. I was just on a mission in Africa a year and a half ago. And there, of course, in Western Africa, the SEPA, it is the Central Bank Afrique. That is the it's almost a common market there.
Mm-hmm. Does Mobutu have anything to do with that?
Well, yes, sir. We're going to merge all of these common markets into one. And you can imagine, all of a sudden, it's terrific. If you have a monopoly over the world, now you literally are king. And I believe that these people are looking toward a one-world economic system.
Mm-hmm.
They describe it as utopia. But as long as we are the sheep and they are the herders, then of course it may be utopia.
Who are these people who want to maintain this kind of control?
Well, Bill Moyers, who's a very respected journalist, identified the Rockefeller family. Not just David Rockefeller or the others. Rockefellers formed the Council on Foreign Relations and also the Trilateral Commission. The stated goals are one world government. Now, the Chase Manhattan Bank, of course, is run by the Rockefellers. Chase Manhattan has ties to hundreds of mega companies like Exxon, and they own like Pan American Airways, and they own ABC and CBS and RCA. And so literally the LA Times, the editor or the publisher of LA Times, of the New York Times, of the Washington Post are all members of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Mm-hmm.
It's their job in the media to sell a naive public on whatever decisions have been made by this round table group. And that's why when you watch the 6 o'clock news, Doctor, you're only entertained.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you pay Peter Jennings, by the way, Dan Rather and all of these other, Mr. Shore, Barbara Walters are all members of the Council on Foreign Relations. When you pay a man $2 million a year, he's not a journalist, he's a showman.
Mm-hmm.
And so thank God, praise God, for talk radio, because that is one way that people can get to the bottom of what must be obvious to them, but must also be very confusing because of the network of deceit that has been very carefully woven by those who would literally sell our birthright.
What can we do as a population unaware and innocent and wanting to do something about this? What can we do to help alleviate this of this evil, you know, perpetrated all over us, all over the country, all over our communities?
Thank you. One, you've already done something. You got mad and you started calling Claiborne Pell. And then when they moved Richard Armitage over to Secretary of the Army out of the State Department, you started calling Sam Nunn. And you caused Richard Armitage to have to resign. Now, we steered America back on course a couple of degrees. One person can't do everything, but mm-hmm. all of us can do something. I have formed a thing called the Center for Action. It's in Boulder City. There's a 1-800 number.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want anyone's money. What I want, Doctor, is for every American who would preserve the birthright of this greatest country on the face of the earth. You don't find boatloads of Americans headed to the Soviet Union. You can call me at 1-800, and the number is 828-6960. If you call 1-800-828-6960, there's daylight hours if you don't mind, so my staff is there.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you'll get a recording. But if you'll leave your name and address, we'll send you out a packet that gives you the proof of all of this information. In the packet is an agreement that Kunsaw has signed and sealed and witnessed that he will stop every ounce of more than 2,200 tons of heroin from coming into the free world and divulge those government officials. Now, Pete Wilson is one of seven senators that sits on the Caucus for International Narcotics Control. He is your senator.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get the people in L.A. to want, call me. Let me send them free of charge all of this information. Let them talk to me to answer any questions that they may have that may still be confusing. Once they are convinced that what we have in that packet, that the government is conspiring, I say the government, not our government,
mm-hmm.
but the government, the unelected government, is conspiring to sell us out, then they get smart on this thing. They then start pressuring Pete Wilson. In the packet is in a letter that we would have them write to Pete Wilson, demanding an investigation of Kunsaw's offer. Now, if we will eventually investigate Kunsaw's offer, then it means that we will expose, we'll lift the rock and see the rats in Washington, D.C. We can cleanse our bureaucracy. Maybe we'll have a chance at free government before we lose our birthright.
Okay.
So we've got the freedom, the Center for Action,
mm-hmm.
and Doctor, you fought for this country, I fought for it. We all bleed alike. The last four letters in the word American spell it out. I can.
Mm-hmm.
We must, if our children are going to survive as we have.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're listening to a 1991 interview with Colonel Bo Greitz, a former Special Forces operative, regarding U.S. government involvement in drug trafficking. The interviewer is Professor Kwaku Person-Lin. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. We continue.